Good morning and welcome to this special edition of The Burning Platform. And we are live a little bit earlier than usual because we've got so much to discuss. Right, Pums?
Yo. As we wake up, what are we, like an hour away from the polls opening in the UK? We've got ministers. We've got a lot more ministers, but fewer ministries.
Well, that's like a poison chalice. And of course, it's also the 4th of July, which brings America into the conversation, as is usual for the Burning Platform. There isn't a day you can't get away with just looking over at what is supposed to be and ostensibly presents itself as the world's greatest superpower. So we probably refer to a little bit of that at some point too. But yes, ministers were sworn in yesterday. And in order to, give us a perspective that is entirely unique and a perspective which I think a lot of people want to hear, we've got none other than Xavier Bapu in the studio with us as well. Hey, Xavier, how's it?
Oh, I'm good, Gareth. Good and Pumi.
So he's been doing a lot of, on X.
Twitter. I still call it Twitter.
A lot of minister watching. It's a lot like... It's a lot like ornithology, that.
Yeah, I think it should be a study on its own. these guys are amazing. The benefits are amazing. And from what we saw people were demanding to what they got, I think it's been a stark contrast. I think the most exciting one was, and we can see how excited he is Keaton McKenzie, who demanded, I'm a Hambe. And he actually got sports and culture, and now he wants to make spending a sport, which is amazing. From where he was campaigning for over 6 months, even 12 months, I would say, now he's got to change direction of his campaign completely.
No, he doesn't have to change any direction.
He shouldn't.
If you consider, in my view, that all that Gayton was doing was trying to get himself into any position.
Yeah, that's true.
If he truly believed on what he was campaigning on and that what he wanted to do was to be in that particular portfolio, he should have said no thank you.
At one point, I think on Twitter, he said he would,
He
would walk away if they didn't give him Home Affairs.
Imagine not being a minister.
I think he was on this show with you guys when he said, I just want power. I will make a deal for power. At least he was honest.
Yeah, he did. He did say that.
He said that to you. I think you guys, and you guys were on the show, and he said, "I'll make any deal for power." And he's actually achieved that, so his voters are not betrayed. But other ministers, it's very interesting.
What for you? What was the most surprising?
I think for me, the most surprising has to be Angie. Okay. I didn't see her staying in cabinet. There was no benefit other than loyalty to the ANC. She's not going to do anything good in SANDF. We know that. And then the second most surprising was Leon Schreiber, because Home Affairs is not his passion. When you look at his history in Parliament, he's never spoken really on Home Affairs. So it's a strange thing. And then the first thing he comes out before he's even sworn in, because they only got sworn in yesterday, but he's been talking about, we're going to fast-track work visas. In a country that has 32% unemployment, you're going to fast-track work visas for foreigners. That's a nice idea. Let's go with that one.
Good for you, Karen. What have you been watching? What have you been seeing?
I'll tell you which positions I'm kind of pleased about. I'm very, very pleased that Velenkosi Hlabisa is now the Minister of Cooperative Governance and Traditional Affairs. I don't think there could have been a better person there. I'm also very pleased that the IFP has representation there and that our friend who was in the studio with us from the IFP is now a deputy minister as well, which is very, very good news. So that was good. I am pleased to see that finance is stable. Of course, I'm not going to say any more than we've already spoken about the markets with the likes of Moeletsi Mbeki, but Enoch Godongwana seems to have his head on right, and now he's got a deputy minister from the DA who can help him out there as well. So between the two of them, they can manage the economy. I think overall, what I'm excited about here is that nobody's thrilled, right? There's nobody who's like delighted. And that proves that this is the right cabinet for South Africa.
Oh, but there is one person who is absolutely delighted. One person who is absolutely delighted. And I think you guys have fallen for the magic trick, the sleight of hand that is Cyril Ramaphosa. What has Cyril Ramaphosa achieved with this?
Unity.
No. Cyril Ramaphosa has now taken one more thing into the office of the president. And what is that? Public enterprises. There is no more public enterprises.
But there shouldn't
and
have
been. All the SOEs
are going under one SOE.
Are now going into the office of the president.
It was a good consolidation.
I absolutely disagree because I don't trust Cyril Ramaphosa worth a damn. And what Cyril Ramaphosa now has is he has, besides all his super 17, no, no, I think at the last count, there were 22 extra ministerial, all sorts of councils, all sorts of red tape cutters, all sorts of individuals who are not elected, who are not responsible or accountable to a party structure, only to Cyril Ramaphosa.
True.
In the office of Cyril Ramaphosa. Mm. And now one more thing, which is all the state-owned enterprises are now sitting in the office of the president.
I don't know. I think, Mpumi, it's a
good
thing.
I'm just saying.
Yeah, no, it's scary.
Watch him.
It is scary because it's a consolidation of power and we should always be cautious about consolidation of power. And especially the way Cyril has done it since 2021. He's been very artful in how he consolidates all the power under his control personally.
So now he's got the SIU?
Yeah. He's got SIU, SSA.
Uh-huh.
What else?
Under his control.
Yeah. And the SOEs are, you know, people underestimate the SOEs because we feel they're all bankrupt. To an extent, they are. But once you control the SOEs, you pretty much control a lot of the market. We're still very active in a lot of the market. You're still very active in the logistics of the country because there's a monopoly with each SOE in their industry. For example, like rail, you can't do anything privately with rail. I wish we could, but we can't.
Well,
you know,
watch so the space.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. Private sector, I must be honest, from all the heads of captains of industry and things, if you say anything against the GNU, these guys get very angry. I've had DMs from people that, you know, I respect, they respect me, and they're like, why are you criticizing GNU? And I'm like, no, this is why. We have to be skeptical on certain appointments and certain things. Like, no, it's an amazing thing. And I'm like, okay.
Gareth, you brought up the stuff that we spoke about with Mwele Tsimbeki. One of the things that I was reminded of what he said to us about the GNU, and the fact that actually you need a government of national unity when you are in crisis. So after a war, when you know, then you need that. We did not need a GNU, but Cyril did.
The ANC is in crisis.
So the ANC, and in fact, what they have done, I think both the ANC and the DA are going to be punished. In the next polls, they're going to be punished. But when I listened to one of the many, 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 many press conferences with Helen Zille during all of the negotiations, especially after the announcement of the cabinet and how much it had ballooned. And she said what I thought was very telling, where she said they did not realize
the size
of cabinet and what it would look like. And that said to me that they were not looking at the big picture. Mm. They were only looking at what they wanted to gain out of it. And what that means is that there was no strategic thinking about how this government of national unity is going to be operating and who the strongest person in which category is. And that for me, I was just like,
I'll let you in on a secret.
Fuck you.
Because it comes at some personal risk, but it is what it is.
I love it.
Anyway,
You can speak softly.
The day that the polls were getting, you know, the day the votes were getting counted, I knew GNU is coming. I knew that's the best way to go. Coalition is out. That will not work. Whether it's EFF, whether it's DA, doesn't matter. A coalition is not going to work. It won't be stable enough. I started messaging the hell out of any ANC cadre that I know, including ministers and things. And I got responses. And it was very interesting because they had a clear mind of what they were going to do. So the GNU was already decided. Then I watched the ANC's website religiously. I'm on there at least four times, five times a week, checking for updates. The GNU document that was sent to each party on the 14th, that was on the website already. That entire document that Helen Zell and Gayton McKenzie signed on the 14th and then others signed afterwards, that was already on the website. It wasn't in the same format, but the same wording, exact, word for word. And I've checked the wording from then till now. Still the same. And I was amazed to see that actually this plan was in motion already. So, you know, Helen Zell is saying she didn't know the size of the cabinet. The reality is a lot of these parties went in demanding what they wanted first. They didn't think, let me phone Gayton, and they could. Gayton and Helen can talk. Gayton and Action SA can talk. And these guys talk. They're on WhatsApps. They can message each other. They're not, you know, they're not at war with each other. They do talk. And you saw it at The Rock. I don't know if you were there, but no. Like I was watching the footage and things. These guys, ANC, DA.
Sitting, I have actually got a life.
Yeah, me too. People don't believe it, but I do. But anyway, you know, these guys talk a lot. And each one had the opportunity to say, what are you asking for? Okay, Gayton, what are you demanding? Let's work together on this. Then we can support your demands. You support our demands. They didn't do that. Instead, each one went to the ANC like, the ANC is king. Here's my tribute. Please give me this in exchange. And then they get surprised when the cabinet is so big. The ANC loves a big cabinet. They've never liked a small cabinet. So was it a surprise? No, Helen Zell has been silly.
Well,
that's my opinion.
It's distributed responsibility and accountability. So you can never really nail any. And that's also why you have deputy ministers, right? So that there can be share of blame. And the ANC has been very clever because basically they're in every portfolio, either as a minister or a deputy minister. So they've covered their arses. They've basically got someone everywhere to take credit, and they've got someone to watch what's happening with the others. So they'll hem them in if necessary. And these minority parties have been trousered, but I still think that the average South African takes things at face value, and we get the government we deserve. And most South Africans are just pleased with the symbolic value of having a whole range of parties and backgrounds and voting blocks and demographics and interest groups distributed through this cabinet. And frankly, South Africans don't mind being ripped off. I mean, we do, but what are we going to do about it, right? I mean, like, look in the city of Joburg, how people are bitching now about the more expensive electricity, which was voted for by all the parties, the parties that care about the poor. And you got the EFF and Good and all of these guys telling us that they care about us.
Perfectly was good campaign.
Yeah, it's nonsense. It's absolute. But it's a disgrace. The fact that people like Patricia DeLille have snuck back in there incenses me, frankly. Because I don't see any reason why they had to include her at all, except that by bringing her in, you just dilute everybody else. That's all you do.
Well, look, if you bring her in, you can bring her in, show unity, and exclude the DA from the tourism portfolio that they did want. So that is strategic. I understand why they brought her in. And also, to be honest, she has kind of helped that portfolio in a small way. I wouldn't give her like an award, but she's been okay. Pabi is right. It's window dressing 101. And something I want to address that no one's addressing is how well Cyril has killed three of the biggest opposition parties in parliament right now. Because there's no way the DA can criticize anyone in cabinet right now. They're pretty much involved. Right. There's no way that VF can criticize anyone. They've got a ministry. And I was very happy to see that appointment. But But they can't criticize anything now because they need to work with the Minister of Police to get this right and the Minister of Justice. So they're all in this together, right? Even though they've got one ministry, that ministry has to work in cooperation with those other two ministers who are ANC ministers. Minister of Justice, I believe, is.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was pretty, the shared accountability has kind of killed all the opposition parties. And we're now left with a fresh opposition, which is now EFF, MK, and Action SA. I didn't see that coming.
So, I mean, what are they called? The Progressive Caucus?
No, that collapsed. There's only, I think PAC was the first to leave. Al Jamal left as soon as they were offered a ministry position. In fact, Al Jamal.
Deputy Minister.
Yeah. Hanif Hendricks said he wanted to be deputy president.
I know. I thought he was just joking. I don't think.
No, that guy eats.
I think it was a jab. But I'm also quite interested to hear your view on what has transpired in Gauteng.
Oof. That one is interesting.
Now, you know, because this yeah.
Yeah. Very interesting because mathematics is not a strong thing in South Africa. You know, we don't understand this percentages. We get swayed by 2%, 3%, 30% unemployment, and then a 38% cabinet.
That's why we end up with a huge bill for electricity because we don't understand what it means when people
don't. We don't understand these things. Like most people can't read a statement. I get surprised about it because in our body corporate, no one can read the financial statements besides me. And I've got no real education in that regard. But anyway, with Lesufi last night, we saw things transpire. Monday was the first signs that there's cracks in the GNU, which now we've seen this new terminology, which didn't occur in KZN, the GPU, the government of
provincial. No, they did. They had it. That's what they said.
They said KZN. It, but it wasn't like a big discussion. Now we're hearing the GPU from Fikile, but no one else is talking about it. But Helen was already saying, over the weekend, it already started that there's cracks in this possible coalition. By Monday, it had gotten quite bad. By Tuesday, the WhatsApps had started going out that said, it's very likely we're not going to be in this coalition. And from the DA people I was speaking to, they were like, Gauteng is gone. I was like, already? You guys are not going to even negotiate? They're like, no, there's nothing to negotiate. I was very confused by this. I'm like, the DA is really taking a hard line on this negotiation. It doesn't need to. One position is better than no positions. You'd rather be in, like even if you're in a portfolio like Agriculture MEC, which Rising Mzansi took last night, you can still make a difference. But the DA was like, nope, it's the highway or no way. And on mathematically, the DA is correct. You need a 41-seat government in GP out of 80 seats. That gives you the majority. Lesufi thinks he can get that right without it. But the
he
problem
needs 41
is,
seats. So
the reason you need 41 seats is when you start passing budgets and things, you need 41 people voting with you. If you don't have that 41 people, you might as well throw your budget in the bin because it's not going to be passed. So now Lesufi has done this government. It's done. We can't change it. When he passes his budget, the DA might be vindictive and say, we're going to vote against it.
I'm really quite fascinated at even the posture of all of the various individuals, right? So watching the press conferences and... my life has been laughing. And when I see it, even just the body language of the various people, there's lots of strife and it's going to be a long 5 years.
Well, unless you move to Western Cape.
It's going to be a long
If you're in GP, you should consider Western Cape. I mean, it's got a majority government there. I would never do it.
I interviewed Nicholas Bauer, who's written this book about Johannesburg. And Nick and I have never really got on because he's always been like a total left winger, but he's very sensible on the issue of Joburg, and he's spent a bit of time in the workings of the city of Joburg. He was employed by them for a time under the DA when they had the mayorship, and he had some interesting observations. Well, we all agreed, Jack Mutlante and Nick and I all agreed that this province is a dirty, filthy, trash heap mess. We've got a no
Wow. Even Lesufi agrees. Wow, guys. Wow.
Even Lesufi agrees. Right? Last night he said that.
I know. And he was tweeting a couple of weeks ago, and I supported him, which I will do whenever anyone. I don't want anyone to think that I'm a stupid partisan who only backs people because of which party they come from. If you haven't noticed by now, I've been accused of being an MK supporter, an ANC supporter, a DA supporter, an EFF supporter, a Freights Front Plus supporter. I don't care anymore. I will support anyone who's doing it.
You're a government of national unity in yourself.
I am. And frankly, I don't have to be one thing. And anyone who tries to put me in a box is going to have a very, very tough time, right? I like what he said the other day about cleaning the province up. He's got like a bunch of people who are dressed in green who are going to go around picking up papers. Can I tell you something?
Crime wardens.
Whatever they are. If he just does that, if they just pick up the papers and make this province, which is supposed to be the economic hub of South Africa, if they just make it look less like a fucking rubbish dump, I am all in for it. That's all I care about. And other than that, I don't care what government do in this province, because provincial government to me is a stupid, unnecessary level in between national and municipal. I care enormously about municipal, and that's why I'm happy about Hlabisa being in cooperative governments, because I think that's where we need to make the difference. Make sure the budgets and the responsibilities and the powers descend down the chain from national to municipal. This in between intermediate level of provincial government is, to me, a completely unnecessary. You talk about portfolios and cabinet being expensive. We have 9 different legislatures that are making rules for 9 arbitrary provinces, which were drawn up by people who were just making shit up in 1994. There are no reasons at all to distinguish Limpopo. There are no reasons to distinguish the Limpopo from Northwest. The people who live in those two provinces are more or less of the same kind. Their economies are quite similar. They're mostly agricultural economies. The people who live in those provinces don't have huge differences between them. It is an arbitrary and unnecessary distinction. We shouldn't have all these provinces. We shouldn't have all these provincial legislatures. We shouldn't have provincial executives. What's the point? We're not the federal United States of America. We are a nation. We're a democracy and a republic. All of this should be much, much more streamlined. Get rid of that middle layer of government. That's why whatever they do, to me, it's a clown show. It's an unnecessary distraction.
I think if they did the work that they were actually supposed to be doing, you'd feel a lot less like that. That's the problem that we have right now, is we have too many people in too many positions doing nothing. That's the problem.
I disagree.
They're not doing anything.
I must be honest with you. We give Lesufi a lot of slack. And
Lesufi gets nothing from
me. No, but like, honestly, to be very frank, they did build schools. They did build libraries.
On a marsh. Let's talk about building a school on a marshland. That was bad. Let's talk about super inflated prices for buying land that's supposedly going to be for human settlement.
But they didn't do nothing.
All that they did was find themselves in positions where they could siphon money from the people. And in return, what the fuck do we have?
He gets nothing
from me. These young people that have been brought in, who are supposedly going to be crime wardens, who are going
to
be...
contracts ended, you know?
Crime wardens. I work in Rosebank. And I watch these young people and their poverty being recycled as they stand on street corners with t-shirts that say, I love Joburg. Supposedly, they're going to help tourists. Do what?
It was window dressing before the election.
And it's bullshit. And it must be called out for the bullshit that it is. Lesufi gets nothing from me.
I don't know. Someone's getting a salary.
I don't have comments, guys. I wish I could see what people's comments were saying, but Jack is trying to help me out.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of Lesufi's policies, but the reality is people are getting salaries. People got jobs.
Him and his friends. Mm-hmm. Him and his cronies.
It's crumbs of the pie versus the big slice of the pie. But to be frank, we can't say they're doing nothing. I'm not happy with what they do.
Okay, maybe we must say they're doing nothing for us.
Nothing for us. That I like. I like that.
They're doing nothing for us. Yeah. They're doing nothing for the job. What am I looking at?
the comments.
The comments.
Guy who moved from
Cape Town.
All right, so Snai says, I moved from Cape Town to Pretoria last month. The GP needs some love and care. Most of the streetlights don't work. The lanes of the road are not clearly marked. The roads are uneven. Robots are work. Okay, so I often visit Cape Town, and I know that you and Xavier, you and Pumi both do as well. It's run better, not because it's run by the DA necessarily. It might be one of the reasons, but also the people in Cape Town seem to have a general sense of not just dropping shit wherever they walk. I feel like in Gauteng, our priorities are a little bit wrong. I feel like we've got things like zamas. I think we've got things like homelessness, which is much, much worse here than it is in Cape Town. I think we've got massive, massive problems that we need to address. But is this the job of a Panyaza Lesufian? Do you think he's genuinely interested in doing any of that? Because I'm with Pumi. Like, he gets nothing from me. I'm not spending a huge amount of time. I can only focus on the local councillor, who I hope is doing her job. And if she isn't, I will vote her out the next time around. And I can only focus on the national government. And I want us to go back to the GNU quickly, because it is the topic of discussion in every house in South Africa. And will be for another couple of weeks. You know why? Because people want to know who's at the top of the hierarchy. So can I ask you what you think is going on in terms of who's the ANC's lead on all of this? Is it Fikile Mbalula? Because I've seen a bit of a turnaround in the way that he's been responding on social media, the way he's responding to media, the way he talks to other parties and about other parties. I think Fikile has risen to the occasion. And I think if anyone's going to get a little bit of credit in this GNU, it's him. I never thought I'd be saying this. But do you think that that's true, or do you think I'm being misled?
You're being misled a little bit, Gareth, because the ANC is a big monster. And there's a lot of people in the background we never see. And you'll never hear of these people until the last moments. And these guys like it that way. They are strategists. They are analysts. They pretty much guide the presidency.
Quiet eatists.
Quiet eatists. I like that. That's a killer. But you notice it when you go to the ANC events. Who's sitting next to the deputy president? Who's talking to the deputy president? What he says after they talk to him and that kind of thing. You know, one of those people that has come to the forefront now is Parks Tau. He's a fantastic strategist. Behind the scenes, he's put a lot of input into this GNU, and I was very impressed that he got appointed as DTIC minister. That said, you know, Fikile is a great people's person, and the ANC has utilized that to a great extent during these negotiations. I can't think of anyone better in the ANC's, you know, you can't send like a Galema Motlanthe. You can't send him. He's too diplomatic. Fikile has got a bit of spice. He's got a bit of humor to him. And he said rightly yesterday that Gayton and him are so similar. They're people's people. And Gayton has managed negotiating with other parties very well. Some people call him a snake. Some people call him a good guy. I seem to think he's a good guy. He understands what's at stake. And he's a people's person. But there's people guiding Gayton as well. He's not just thinking up all these things by himself. So Fikile, he's done his role well. But I don't think he's in charge of anything. I think he's been told what is necessary.
All right.
I think we've got, all I'm saying, I think we've got a long 5 years, and I keep feeling like, and this last statement about Fikile and who the real power players are within the party is exactly the kind of thing that I think we need to pay more attention to and shine a light on. Because I think the next 5 years, there's going to be a lot more sleight of hand from various people.
Absolutely.
I think there is going to be a lot more looting from a lot of places.
It will be legitimate looting.
I think, and I think that there is a lot of pain up ahead for South Africa and for South Africans. I think I will be happy to be wrong.
I will be happy to be wrong, but
with Cyril, guys, I've not been wrong.
Yeah, no, I agree with you, Pumi.
This show.
We need to keep a watch out, but the impressive thing for me has been the captains of industry that are so positive. We saw it in 2019 where they had Ramaphosa.
They are colluders.
Yeah, true.
They have colluded in the pain that we feel, guys.
In all of this, right, there is a lot of opportunity for us with new brooms that are going to try and sweep clean. Like if you've
who's the new broom, sir?
No, let's talk Home Affairs, right? VFS has the contract with Department of Home Affairs to process all the work visas in South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
They got this contract exclusively.
Mm-hmm.
This was a Gupta-era Maluzi Gigaba drama. It is possible now for a South African company, because VFS is not a South African company, it's an Indian company.
Mm-hmm.
It's possible now for a South African entrepreneur to go to Home Affairs Minister and say, listen, it's unfair that VFS has the entire contract for DHA. If you give us Cape Town, we'll process the work visas for Cape Town exclusively. That opportunity might be there. I'm not saying it will happen. I would love that opportunity. But we can approach someone new. It's not an ANC minister anymore. There's no, you know, comradeship there between the VFS guys.
Do you see my face right now? Do you see the resting bitch face?
You're not wrong. You're not wrong.
Because.
But there's opportunity. We must take.
There's opportunity to add more people and their grabby hands into the pot.
No, look, these contracts exist for a reason. Almost everything the government does, they subcontract at some point. Unfortunately,
I'm afraid we got to wrap this conversation up because we've got another guest joining us in a short while. I just want to say that I'm really, really pleased that there are at least, I mean, as far as I can tell, and I've just had, again, a glance at this cabinet, I can see only two dyed-in-the-wool commies. I think that one of our biggest problems has been the sleight of hand that Pumi's referring to, in that we had a bunch of actual commies, Ibrahim Patel, and there are only two that I can see in here now who are actually like real true believer trademark commies, and they are Barbara Creasy and Bladen Zimande. And other than that, the rest seem far more pragmatic, even if they're not all, you know, the most qualified in that particular portfolio. That's never been an issue. And please, in this country, when last did we have someone who was supremely specialist in their portfolio? They're not. So just count our blessings on that front, because the less commies, the greater our chances of actually growing the country. So, all right. Enough of this, and thank you very much, Xavier. Thank you for joining us this morning. It's always good to have your opinion.
The best thing about the GNU is
what?
Is that elections happen in cycles,
yes.
and there's going to be serious the pain that South Africans are feeling today, and will be feeling for the next 5 years. That pain is going to be shared with these silly politicians, because when we come around to the polls next time, the people.
It could be the reverse. We could vote for them. Let's see. All right. Thanks, guys. Just
shame, guys. Oh, Julius. We didn't even get to talk about Julius.
Well, no.
Relocating late in the day. Being left out.
So this is the beauty of it, right? Is that actually, if Cyril's performed any masterstroke at all, it is that his greatest worry was always the MK guys and the EFF. And what he's done is he's excluded them completely. They're going to be making a noise from the outside now, and they're going to be a reduced opposition. They don't have anyone else to help them. As you said, this progressive caucus has fallen apart. Xavier reminded us that the rest of them have left. So now you're going to hear the sideshow and the clowns from the circus next door, and that's all their role is going to be reduced to. So whoop-tee-doo. The best place for the EFF is going to be on X, on Twitter.
And they've been very muted there too.
Yeah, they have. I mean, by and large. And so is MK actually since the election. And they also can't decide. Did you see, Pumi, that they wanted MK, all 58 of their seats in parliament, they wanted all the money paid into one account, and then they would distribute that money as they saw.
I love that for them. All the money on a conveyor belt to Mkandla.
Yeah, how's that? So all right, let us get on to this, because I'm very excited to welcome our guest. He's someone who's also been on the show before. And last time he was here, he also dropped a bunch of pearls of wisdom. Today is going to be no different. We've got Alan Mendoza, who's the co-founder and executive director of the Henry Jackson Society, Britain's leading think tank, fighting for the principles and alliances which keep societies free. He directs strategy for the organization, as well as acting as the main public face in the print and broadcast media. Fellow of the Royal Society of Arts, a trustee of the President Reagan Memorial Fund Trust, yay, July the 4th, He's a Westminster City Councillor and was the parliamentary candidate for the Conservative Party in the Brent Central constituency for the 2015 general election. Of course, as we know today, the Brits go to the polls again. So we've got that right up front to talk about, Alan, and we'll get into some other stuff in a moment, but welcome back to the show. I think you're on mute. Mm-hmm. There we are. I think we can hear you now. Go ahead. Nope.
We can't hear. We still can't hear.
Is that any better? Can you hear me now?
We are. Now we can hear you. Thank you. Very good.
Right. Hello, Gareth. Hello, Pumi. How are you today on this momentous day for us?
Less than an hour to go and your polls open.
Well, yeah.
Is it really? I've seen less excitement in the third world where the vote is actually not even a thing. I've never seen a more muted response to candidates or to options among the people of Britain in my memory. I don't know anyone who's excited about the prospects of either Rishi or Keir. I don't know anyone. Am I missing something?
I think Keir is probably quite excited about the prospect of Keir. he's been very excited all the way through the campaign. No, but you're right. There's been a noticeable lack of enthusiasm for the main parties in the UK for this election. I think people have in a sense had enough of politics. They've gone, well, we don't think the current lot have done that well so far. Some of us, note there are circumstances that might reflect why they haven't done so well, but we're still not going to give them much credit. We're not particularly excited about what the opposition might do when they get in as well. But of course, the irony is that despite this lack of enthusiasm, the polls are telling us that, the Labour Party will be getting an absolutely massive supermajority, the kind of supermajority the ANC used to enjoy. But of course, unlike the ANC in its genuine popularity heyday, when it was getting, the number of seats that matched the number of votes it got, it's likely that, again, looking at the polls, the Labour Party could get as much as 70% of the seats with only about 40% of the polls. That's just how our electoral system works. So we're going to end up potentially today, if voters don't change their minds and have been saying to the opinion pollsters what they actually are going to do, that Labour will get this massive enthusiastic majority with none of the enthusiasm you might expect to back that majority up.
Alan, Gareth, you go first.
How did this happen to the Conservative Party? How did they fuck it up so badly? Because I just don't. I mean, it's not as if Keir Starmer is the most charismatic man on earth. It's not as if Labour have suddenly come up with some unbelievably brilliant policy idea. It's not as if the British people are clamoring for something which Labour are offering them. How did it get to this point? How did, and the Conservatives, I think you'll admit this first and foremost, but they've got to own up to having really screwed things up here.
Well, I think, I think the one thing the Conservatives have done, for a while now is to admit that things have not gone as well as they should have done. But in answer to how this has happened, I think you've got two different things going on. Number one, like many incumbent governments, they had to face both COVID and the Ukraine war price shocks, which, of course, sent inflation spiraling high. No doubt about it, that obviously led to a very difficult situation economically. That was then exacerbated by various mistakes that were made, I think, by Conservative governments. I mean, I think if we look back on the COVID times, the massive amount of public money that was spent at the time, which was obviously borrowed, that was, the chickens were obviously going to come home to roost on that at some point. And when you have the inflation and the very, very brief Liz Truss premiership, which in my view had the right ideas, but went about it in such an appallingly cack-handed manner that it got everyone offside, including, of course, crucially, the City of London, the financial markets. That, of course, led to a massive shock. And I think most governments, when you look back to pivotal moments, I think we can look back, say, to the 1992 Conservative government, which had, of course, Black Monday, and you ended up with Black Wednesday, whatever it was, that the moment when interest rates shot up to 15% because they were pursuing a certain financial policy. At that point, all trust is lost. And if you look at what happened to the Conservatives polling, it was a Liz Truss premiership. That shock, if you like, to sort of bank rates and interest rates and what happened there, that from that moment on, the Conservatives never recovered. So, look, general bad circumstances, some bad decisions, the Liz Truss interregnum, and the Conservatives never recovered. And I think then you look at that from what happens at the polling today, and you look at what people are saying, they just didn't believe the Conservatives were probably going to turn things around, even though economically the indicators were looking more promising. I think people have memories and they go, you know what, we've had enough at this point in time. At least that's what the polls say. And that's what we're going to do. Just one note of caution, of course. There has been some movement in the last couple of days. I don't think anyone believes, including the Conservative Party, there'll be a Conservative victory today. The big question in British politics is, what's the size of Keir Starmer's majority? That we'll have to wait and see.
Well, I have a question then, Alan. Talking about the dark night of the soul that the Conservatives are experiencing at the moment, which I think they probably need the time away from the glare of running the country to fix themselves up and fix their internal issues, the way that Labour has done over the past 9 years. I am quite interested to know what, if Nigel Farage could pull an MK on you guys, because Nigel Farage is out conservating the Conservatives, right? Could he pull an MK?
Well, this is the, so it's very interesting you use that analogy. I mean, first, let's just unpack, you know, some of what you said. So Labour have, of course, been on a journey. And over the last 5 years, Keir Starmer, since he took over from Jeremy Corbyn and essentially, you know, decommunised the party, has done quite well, hasn't he? If you think about it, in 2019, they got the worst result for Labour since 1935. And nobody thought they'd be in this position today. And yet they are. And part of that is because Starmer did ruthlessly go after the communist elements, the hard left elements within the Labour Party and change the party. And we can look at that a bit later on. But you're right, there are other circumstances going on. And I think the circumstances that, you know, look at the reform vote, the Nigel Farage vote, I think for a while there has been this, if you like, this populist right-wing element in British politics. And we saw it, didn't we, first with Brexit in a major way. That's what sparked, you know, sort of a big populism. And it's been, you know, the Nigel Farage image ever since. Could he achieve what Mr. Zuma did? He can't, because the way our electoral system works will not give him the percentage of seats in the House of Commons that would, you know, match his votes, because we run on a first-past-the-post system, which is a, if you like, a pluralistic system. You don't have to win a majority of any particular seat. You just have to win one more vote than the next party. That's how you win. Now, the trouble for him is that the reform vote is split quite evenly across the country. We do expect there to be some reform MPs this time, but it'll be nowhere near in proportion to the number of people who say he votes. And just to show you how ridiculous the system is, the Liberal Democrats, who are traditionally our third party, are polling at about the same amount as reform, but they will likely get somewhere between, according to polls, 40 to 60 seats. And reform will get somewhere between, if they're lucky, 5 seats. So that tells you that there won't be a reform moment parliamentary-wise, but they will potentially have an outsized impact on the election. If you look at what the Conservatives have been doing for the last few weeks, it's been saying to people, look, we understand you want to vote for reform. We get that you like their policies. But if you vote for reform, you're going to get Labour, because you'll take votes away from the Conservatives. And in a number of very tight marginal seats where there could be a few hundred votes between the parties, those votes coming off the Conservatives mean the Labour candidate will win. And so it'll be interesting to see what exactly the Farage effect will actually be in British politics today.
It's going to be, I mean, Gareth says it hasn't been exciting and all for a lot of the Brits. But I think as a person who watches politics, what all of this kind of movement over the past 5 years has really been an interesting case study, as it were, of seeing what it takes to, within an organization, speaking about Keir Starmer and what he's been able to do in Labour, within an organization, pull a turnaround to a place where now you're sitting very, very pretty, even if you don't have a charismatic leader, even if you don't have exciting policies. I mean, I looked at a YouGov, kind of the top 10 hot button issues, and just looking at those things, they're not even talking about them. You know, they're tax is one of the hot button issues, and they're talking about more taxation. Health is a hot button issue, and the mess in the NHS, all of those things, and yet they're sitting pretty to have a landslide, as it were. You know, as a case study, it's pretty something to watch.
No, it's amazing. I think Labour strategy has been described as the Ming vase strategy. Now, why is it the Ming vase strategy? Because imagine you're holding a very expensive Ming vase as you walk across a room. You've got to get to the other side without dropping the vase. And so what Labour were determined to do throughout this election process was not to get into too much detail into their policies. Because if you did that, the vase might break. Someone might go, hang on, I don't like that policy. That sounds terrible. So they have given very minimal details. I can't recall another British election when we know so little, frankly, about what the likely governing party is going to put in. If you look at the two manifestos very quickly, the Conservatives at least have some detailed policies. You may not like them, but they've got some detailed policies. Labour have got a lot of talk about we're going to revitalise British industry, but no sense of how we're going to get there. So it's a very strange moment. You're right, Premier, because we don't know that much about Labour's agenda.
Yeah, I mean, to my opening comments about how boring this is for most people inside or outside of Britain, I've never seen a British election that so closely resembles a Canadian one.
I mean, great Canadian election. Look, everyone's talking about 1993 as a result. I mean, that was extraordinary. If you remember when the Conservative Party was wiped out, people are talking this could be the Conservative Party's 1993 Canada moment here.
Sure.
To my point, it's the most Canadian British election ever. All right, so let's just cast our minds a little further afield and go into some of the detail. I know you've got quite a lot that you can share with us this morning, and I've got tons and tons of questions about just so many things that are going on. So let's just look at the rest of Europe for a starter, because even though Brexit's happened, and who knows, Keir Starmer and there are a bunch of people who are still in Labour who may very much want to claw back some of the things that were promised under the Conservatives and in that referendum, which is now, you know, of blessed memory to some and of a serious sense of ire and hatred to others. Europe is making a very impassioned and deliberate move in the opposite direction. France and and let's just talk about the French elections. And actually, perhaps it would be instructive. I know you're one of the few people who can do this for us. Instructive for you to just explain to us how the French election works, because most people don't understand. Why do we have to have
another round on Sunday?
The French always have to do everything differently, don't they?
Always, always. It's absolutely very important for the French to be different and to have the system that nobody else follows because it's a French way. I always remember many years ago when I was speaking to NATO commanders about the French had come back into NATO having been sort of fully back into the military command, having sat aside for a while. And they were trying to, kind of get the integration of the French military. And one general described it to me as following way. He said, look, most of us, in Europe and in America, we have this sort of tank, this sort of, sort of artillery piece, this sort of gun. The French have a tank which have a turret going that way rather than that way. Their artillery, sort of is nobody could work out how to integrate the French machinery because it's all different. And that's very reflective of their electoral plumbing as well. So they've got a two-round system. What they're trying to do, I understand the sense of what they're trying to do. They're trying to get a more majoritarian point of view. So in round one, if a candidate, so they do divide it up seat by seat. If in every seat the candidate of one party does not get 50% of the vote, with at least 25% of the voters voting, if they do get that, they're elected straight away. So in France, there won't be across the country, there'll be some seats already where someone last week got 50% of the vote and at least in 25% of the people voted, they're elected. But in the second round, there's a qualification process. If you get above a certain amount of votes, then it's either two or three, I think possibly even four technically, people could end up in a runoff where then only one person wins in that second round. And what they're trying to do, I get it to a sense, they're trying to exclude the minority parties, the parties who got very little. So the person who does get elected has the biggest mandate possible from within the area. Now, what that does is encourage horse trading, because what you've seen in the last week is a set of political parties making deals, as it were, not everywhere, but in a lot of constituencies, you're going to end up with only two candidates fighting one another. And that will be the national rally candidate from the populist right or the far right, depending on how you see them. And then you'll see a candidate from somewhere else on the political spectrum. Now, that might be Mr. Macron's party. It might be the Republicans, which are the equivalent of the old-star conservatives. Or it might be from the Popular Front coalition, which brings in the traditional socialists, but also, of course, the hard left party of Mélenchon. And so you're going to try and see a concerted effort to block Le Pen's party from winning a majority on Sunday. And I would say she's going to find it very difficult to win a majority now.
And then the people of France who will feel that they haven't been heard yet again by commies, as they always do, will just vote even harder right in the next election. And this is going to keep happening until they get the government that they want. The majority of the French people seem very much to be anti-immigration. They seem to like what Marine Le Pen is talking about. They've had enough, and no one's listening to them, least of all the opposition politicians who just cannot see when they've lost.
Well, look, I think it's important to note, obviously, that Le Pen has not won a majority in vote share of the French people. I mean, I think that percentage was 30-something. So that's not a majority. It's not over 50%. But I do think there is a broad consensus in France that the migration situation is out of control. That's why, of course, that has been driving her party. And you're right. If you keep on excluding a party from office and the situation that has driven much of that party's support continues, then the inevitable result will be to keep on voting for that party, and her percentage will go up and up and up. And I think right now, you know, the theory is that even if she doesn't make the majority in the National Assembly, they'll come pretty close. That will obviously make it very difficult for anyone to govern anyway in the National Assembly. And that sets it up well for her in 3 years' time, or whoever might be the candidate, might be the 28-year-old whiz kid Bardella. Maybe, you know, that might be the sort of the candidate, but whoever it is will stand very well to go in. But it is worth looking at the trends. As you were saying, Gareth, it's interesting. If you look across the continent of Europe for the past, you know, few years, we have seen these populist parties, these far-right parties. Again, I distinguish the two because there are some of these continental parties that would be traditional far-rightist parties, maybe even, frankly, racist parties. I'm not a big fan, for example, you know, in Germany, of where their party is going in this sense. But if you look at someone like Geert Wilders in the Netherlands, you know, he got very high 30, you know, I think 6 or 7% in the Dutch elections. And of course, his party is now in a coalition government and will have the chance to influence the Dutch, you know, the way the Dutch think in the coming years. You've seen other parties, the Sweden Democrats, Meloni in Italy, of course, others who are in government and who now have the chance to influence things. And of course, the question for those parties is how much will they be able to influence their coalitions? Because like you are now discovering the joys of coalition government and compromises that need to be made. And we've seen lots of compromises, you know, in South Africa, particularly from the DA, to get into that coalition. Well, I think, you know, people like Wilders have made a lot of concessions to get into the coalitions in the Netherlands, and other parties have done. And you won't get, you know, that party's pure agenda coming in. It has to be a mishmash. And so that's what we're going to see, a mishmash of policies coming across Europe. And the question is that going to be enough to satisfy voters who are fed up with the status quo? And those voters, yes, they are swinging to the right, but they're also voting for hard left parties. And that's interesting as well, to look across the continent, that there are some hard left parties who are also doing very, very well as outsider parties from that side. And it's just a general revolt, if you like, about
it is a very polarized world. You know, more and more people are moving to the extremes, you know, where for a long time, a lot of centrist ideology, a lot of centrist kind of let's all get along and we can make things happen and we can make things work. But because over the past couple of years, the inflation all over the world has been problematic, housing, healthcare, all of those kinds of things is what has created this incredible polarization. And where you see the hard right coming up is because people are having to compete for resource. And they're saying, I do not want to have to compete for the little resource there is within this country with people who are not from around here or people who look like me. But I'm also interested to hear your view just in terms of foreign policy. And I feel forgetting, I suppose, of something that's been, particularly in Europe, a very big part of the conversation, Ukraine and Russia. You know, it's kind of the interest is waning there. People are not talking so much about what Zelensky is doing or what Putin is thinking of doing. You know, people are much more interested in their own internal politics.
Yeah, no, I think that's very, very true. And I think, firstly, the fate of all wars is that the longer they go on, the more they're forgotten, as it were. If you look at, you know, the front pages 2 years ago, compared to if there had been an election 2 years ago in the UK, say, I'm sure Ukraine would have been front and centre of what's happening. But you're right, it hasn't really factored into British politics, and it hasn't really factored much into European politics either. And it's interesting that the reason for that is that on the Ukraine question, most of Europe is settled on an answer. It is, we don't like Mr. Putin and we want to help Ukraine. It is interesting to note that Nigel Farage made some throwaway comments the other day here about, oh, maybe it wasn't Putin's fault that the war started, or you know, maybe it was, you know, there was some provocation or there were issues there. Now, he's walked back from those comments and said he was misinterpreted. But it had an impact. People didn't like it. They didn't like that he had strayed into that territory. And I think it's interesting as well, in France, the National Rally, who were very cozy with Mr. Putin some time ago, also walked back from that during this campaign and didn't talk much about it at all. They said, no, we'll continue supporting Ukraine. We just won't send offensive weapons that might hit Russia, that might hit within Russia, to Ukraine. So it's interesting that there seems to be a settled consensus in much of Europe on the Ukraine conflict. Now, where there is not a settled consensus is on the Gaza conflict, of course.
Yeah.
That has had an impact on some elections, and it may have an impact on our election here, because there is a sizable constituency of people who are very unhappy with the Labour Party stance on Gaza. These are traditional Labour-voting Muslim communities, in particular in the UK, who have been very aggressive on the Gaza issue and have been very offended that the Labour Party has not taken their position on this, which is that Israel should give up, basically, and Britain should be, you know, demanding a ceasefire and doing everything it can to force Israel into complying with one. And we've yet to see how that will impact electorally today, but it did have an impact, amazingly, on our local elections a couple of months ago, where Labour lost a large chunk of support in majority Muslim areas, presumably from Muslim voters. And we haven't, you know, analysed the data to that extent, but they lost a big chunk. And they're very worried that in some seats today, despite being massively ahead, that Muslim voters may, and some you know, far left-wing voters, may vote for independent candidates or for other candidates who promise a ceasefire in Gaza. So it's quite extraordinary that on this issue, there are some voters who will put that above the NHS, the cost of living, economy, any of that sort of thing, and will say, I'm voting on Gaza in the UK today, which is amazing if you think about it, because that is not what should be happening.
I had actually never thought of that dynamic within the UK until last Saturday when I saw Rishi Sunak go to the temple. And I thought, of course he's going to go to the temple. He's Hindu, right? But interestingly, to then see Keir Starmer also go to a Hindu temple. And I thought, I suddenly thought to myself, oh, okay, so this is also a dynamic that, you know, that plays out in...
This performative... pandering bullshit that politicians are all about these days is just, I mean, it is maddening to me. I find that it's all so vacuous and unimportant, and so many of these opinions and positions are the most, they're just blatant. I mean, this is the end of banal multiculturalism, as Christopher Hitchens called it. You know, where everybody just pretends that everybody else is the same and we all get along and everything's equal and we don't have to discriminate between this and that. And there's no such thing as Britain and there's no such thing as Europe. And actually, it's one big world. Let's all hold hands and make policies together. Doesn't work that way. Europe's turning its back on that nonsense. And I think it's right that the Labour Party has said, we're not going to condemn Israel. We're not going to let them just give up now that they're winning. And I think that this is one of the few signs that I've seen from the Labour Party in a long while, that they're not just giving in to wokeism and multiculturalism, that they actually do have to stand for something in order for them to be able to represent the majority of the people of Britain. And of course, they're going to be these neighbourhoods where they, you know, they're going to alienate themselves from the constituents. But that's as a direct result of everything that's happened since the 70s. And Britain now has to account for those things. Listen, I've got friends and family in Britain, but I'll tell you what, there is a lot of whining and whinging and moaning and complaining going on there, which has become the national sport. And I know everybody's saying it's coming home with respect to football trophies, But the only thing that's coming home, the only thing coming home, in my opinion, is the chickens to roost as a result of really, really lax, boring, dull, banal multiculturalism. There we go.
Well, look, this is a really interesting subject because what we are potentially seeing, don't know, we won't know until the results are in, but what we're potentially seeing is, you know, Britain's first sectarian voting election. Because a lot of focus has been going on how people from different religions might be voting. And, you know, there have been sort of issues that have been designed, if you like, by the parties to actually pander to various communities in a way that you wouldn't have found even 10, 15 years ago. Totally different. And the reason that's happening is because Britain's demography has changed quite demonstrably. So those, you know, chickens, the 1970s were a start, but it was the 1990s, 2000s under the Tony Blair government, which, you know, fundamentally affected a demographic shift in the UK. If you look at the demography of the UK, the big shift happened then with the migration policy, which was a conscious policy by Labour at the time, to allow and encourage people from different parts of the world to come to the UK to, frankly, yeah, just change the makeup of the nation. That's, you know, realistically what happened as a result of their policies. And what we're now living with are the consequences of having mass migration on a large scale in the UK, but without necessarily the integration policies that were required, hard integration policies that turn people into that, you know, dream of everyone is just a Brit. Doesn't matter what your faith is, what your, you know, what your skin color is, you're a Brit. You fundamentally share the same values. Unfortunately, what we're seeing now is an increasing number of people in the UK who don't share the same values. There are people who, you know, want various different things from the bulk of their neighbours. And the danger with that is that if that number continues to increase, whether it is through migration or through just natural growth, without, again, integration policies, you will end up having a split and fractured nation of the kind Britain is not used to dealing with, or Europe is not used to dealing with. And I think most European countries are coming to, you know, to some conclusions about the nature of this problem, and that something dramatic has to be done about it before it gets too late. Because if you wait another 10 or 20 years, that demographic issue is going to change and change again. And so we are facing, as you say, this sort of crisis of what do we do as a country to integrate people and bring people onto the same hymn sheet, and no real answers have been given by any of the major parties about how you do it.
You know, talking about that demographic, and it's a nice way to get to this, because one of the things that I'm very interested in when it comes to politics and how campaigns are run is also the communication aspect of campaigning and electioneering. And Britain has a very fascinating system, and I find the British debates far more exciting than the American ones because of the way that the formats are run. And it was interesting for me when I looked at the ITV debate between Rishi and Keir, and it was kind of a little bit like, I don't know. I wonder how communication has played a role. And I saw your interview talking about deepfakes in this electioneering process and some of those scandals that we've seen and how the various parties have responded to a very, very changed format of communicating with their constituencies. So can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's a really interesting subject. And I think you start off from the premise, of course, that those leadership debates that we've had are very new things. We never used to have those. Mm. That's all an American construct that has been sort of brought into British politics in the last 15, 20 years. And, you know, you never saw Margaret Thatcher, for example, debating Neil Kinnock. It never happened in that sort of way. So that's already a new thing. It's trying to appeal directly to voters. Most famously in 2010, the leadership debates there really had an impact on people. And it was done because Nick Clegg, he was a Liberal Democrat leader at the time, he was acknowledged to win the debates at home, and it gave them a real boost in the polls. He did something very interesting. Rather than talk to the people across the stage, he looked straight at the camera and went, I'm going to talk to you at home instead, which was a really new thing at the time. And nobody could believe he was doing it, but he did it and it helped in that sort of way. Now, in today's world, what people are looking for, the TV stuff is fine, but not many people actually tune into those debates in terms of, you know, as in the old days. The social media aspect has been big in terms of the communication. Yes, of course, the parties do the traditional stuff. You knock on doors, you put leaflets through letterboxes, you know, Royal Mail when it works. You know, there's been a whole scandal about, no, there's been a whole scandal about postal boats not making it to people because Royal Mail haven't delivered them. So, you know, there's a sort of a weird situation here where things do come through your door, but sporadically, and you know, when Royal Mail feels like it. Those things happen. I'm sure you do. Yeah, I'm sure you do. But we're not used to this sort of failure of, you know, the major, this is Royal Mail we're talking about. It's supposed to be the sort of gold standard, and it hasn't been in this election, unfortunately. But people are trying to get hold of how do you reach, you know, younger people in particular, and who don't watch TV. And the way you do it is by social media. So you're seeing, obviously, all the social media platforms being utilized for very different styles of commentary and for different styles of adverts. And obviously, what you see on TikTok is very different to what you might see on Facebook in terms of the style of adverts. And, you know, the ultimate example of this is again, the Liberal Democrats. They've run a bizarre campaign where Ed Davey, their leader, has specialized in weird stunts like falling into a river or jumping off a button, you know, doing these weird things to try and, frankly, break through the consciousness of people to go, who's that bloke? And what's he? Oh, he's a political party leader. Oh, he's jumped off a cliff. Let's hear what he's got to say, you know, this sort of way. So it is interesting that the approach of parties has changed somewhat and they're trying to reach out. And you mentioned, of course, deep fakes. There was a fear this election would be marked by deep fakery, by, you know, pretend videos coming out of candidates saying that. That hasn't been seen, interestingly. Thank goodness it hasn't been seen. And maybe it would have made the election more exciting had we seen it. But instead, we end up with, you know, just a sort of more general approach that people are doing. And I have to say, this won't be known as a particularly innovative election. You're not going to look back on this and go, oh, this technique was pioneered for the first time. The party's not run that sort of campaign here, unfortunately, for innovation. Mm-hmm. So it's still very much a recognisable campaign, just with a bit of social media thrown in.
And frankly, who needs deep fakes when the Lib Dem leader is doing stupid stuff all on his own? He doesn't need you to create the deep fake. He'll just make it himself in real
color. It is incredible.
Live, you know, and isn't that the apogee of performative politics? It's all mind blowing. So let's turn our attention to the other place.
Gareth, before we go to another place, I have one last question, because what is an election without a scandal? So. Don't roll your eyes at this. I think that very fascinating scandals in this election, especially the betting scandal.
I mean, what a ridiculous scandal. Of all the scandals you could drag up, here we have a situation where, look, there's an investigation, so I don't know what's going to happen, but it would appear that certain people who may well have known about the election day then went down to the bookies and gone, ooh, we're going to say it's going to be on this date. Now, how do you... And of course, there's a Labour candidate who bet against himself, and he's been... There's all sorts of... There's a lot of Conservatives knew the election they'd appear to have done. They've won some money. He will, you know, presumably win some money, or given the way that Labour are doing, he might have lost the bet anyway. Who knows? But look, it is crazy that people have been allowed to put bets on this sort of thing. And if you were, just one moment, if you were one of the people who knew the election date, on what planet did you think that you could go down to a bookies, place the bet, and nobody would realise and go, oh, that's a strange bet to replace, that he said July the 4th would be the election. Let's see who he is. Oh, he's an MP who works with the Prime Minister. Could he have known about it? I think between us and your listeners, if you were going to do it, why wouldn't you get a third party to place a bet for you? What kind of idiocy means you put the bet in your own name? I don't understand the sort of incompetence of the betters in this sort of sense. But it's a ridiculous scandal. The people who are being investigated, they better hope they didn't know what the date was and that they weren't done in that sort of way. Because if they did, I'm sorry to say, it's a really low-grade, but still serious corruption scandal. It's just a pathetic
I think it's very, very British, that, of all things here. So Alan, let's just talk about America, because there have been some seismic movements since the debate, which was an absolute unmitigated disaster for Joe Biden, for the Democrats, and for the media in America. It has revealed them all to have been gaslighting everyone and thinking they could get away with it for the longest time. They've had a cadaver running, and put him out in public for just long enough so that he doesn't run out of brain chemistry to be able to carry on saying a sentence. And we've got a total implosion inside of donors, Democratic advisors, White House insiders, staff, mainstream media allies of the Democratic Party, but I repeat myself. And all of these people are suddenly forced to come to terms in order to save their own credibility with Joe Biden's senility by saying, oh my God, we were so horrified by what we saw on Thursday, as if there was no clue that this was happening before. And I don't think I'm being unfair in saying that. It's not just about one old man. This is actually about an entire
system,
system of lies and deceit and corruption that's falling down around the very people that honestly deserve it.
I mean, yes, you're so right to highlight this. This hasn't come out of nowhere. It's not that he had a bad night. He's been having lots of bad nights and days for some time. And in a sense, you feel, you do feel sorry for him personally. He's 82. He doesn't look great. He's been, these mistakes are happening all the time. And you kind of wonder who's actually really pushing him. Is it himself or is it people around him who don't want him to give up power? And there's a great 1980s film that I think explains what's going on. I don't know if any of you have seen Weekend at Bernie's. Have you seen that? Seen that? You have. You're right. So you know about it. This is what's happening here. So in Weekend at Bernie's, those who haven't seen it, the host of a party, this big party, dies before the party starts. And so rather than tell everyone and then not have the party, they go, maybe we should just get away with it. Maybe we'll just carry him around and wave his hand to people. And no one sees Bernie for long enough to know he's dead, basically. And this seems to be what's happening in America. But people around Biden are encouraging him to keep on going because they don't want to lose the trappings of power. I think that's what this is about. It's about a closed circle of people around him who have become used to, frankly, running the country while he is, asleep. And that's they don't want to give up the power.
I want to throw something in there because this is something I'm absolutely, as a citizen of the free world and as someone who actually worries about, all these people who keep telling us they're defending democracy, I actually do care about this. These are unelected people who have in the shadows been maneuvering and pulling the levers of power. The nuclear football is never far away from the president, but he doesn't know where the hell he is. So who is actually in charge of these things? Who has, frankly, been making policy for the last perhaps three years, maybe even longer? Who has been silently manipulating things? And how the hell can the Democrats, who keep on telling us that January the 6th is the most dangerous thing that's ever happened in America, be totally okay with an entirely shadowy bunch of people whose names we don't know, whose faces we don't know, who were not elected and have never been on any ballot? Let them run the government, an administrative state. How has this happened? And how can we just pretend, okay, it's about an election, and let's just put Kamala in with 18% approval?
Well, I mean, this is the interesting part. I mean, look, if you Google online, you'll find who these people are. I mean, they're not secretive people in the sense that you don't know who they are. Their names are all, there. You can find out who they are. They occupy various positions in the administration.
They're not elected.
Clearly. No, they're not elected. No, this is the interesting part. They're not elected. And this is the worrying part that Biden is clearly not up to the job. He's clearly not a 24/7 president. Look, there are times when he remains still lucid and you understand what he's saying, but there are clearly times. And what's worrying is the New York Times, who have suddenly come out against him, having covered him so long, have pointed out, well, what's worrying is that the bad days in the last 6 months, I think we've all seen this, haven't we? We've seen a slew of things in the last 6 months that have seen, it's almost, every second day something's happening that suggests he's not really with it. And that's a real problem. His rate of deterioration is such that, you can't imagine what's going to be like in 3 months' time before the election, let alone in 3 years' time, should he be re-elected, which looks now increasingly unlikely, what's actually going to happen? And you're right. The question, therefore, is what do we do about it? And what do people do about it? Now, if the Democratic Party had any sense and any sort of, as you say, commitment to democracy, they would replace him now. And put someone else in. Now, I don't think that person will be Kamala Harris. I think Kamala Harris, as you say, 18% popularity. She is not a popular figure. And it would, I think, be worrying to the American people where he to be on the ballot at the top in November and she's a likely successor. I mean, that's a guaranteed recipe to lose the election, actually. I think more and more Democrats realize that and are very concerned about it. Now, I don't know who they pick instead, but the reality is that almost anyone they pick instead, almost anyone, will do better in that general election now than Joe Biden will, and frankly, would probably be Donald Trump as well, because Donald Trump is also a flawed candidate, as we well know. You want to know how this happened, how we ended up with Biden? It's because we had Donald Trump on the other side. That's how it ended up with Biden. If you cast your mind back 4 years ago, the Democrats were worried about who might be able to beat Donald Trump, and they picked the one guy who they thought had some long-standing American name recognition and was regarded as a, you know, as a vague centrist at the time, okay? And they put him forward on the basis that he could beat Donald Trump. Of course, then you had the COVID stuff that meant he wasn't very well scrutinized. He was the least scrutinized candidate in American political history, I think, in modern American political history, Joe Biden, because of COVID. Yeah, because the media hated Trump so much they wanted him out. Okay? That's why we got him.
Famously, Joe Biden spent the entire campaign in his basement doing nothing.
He did, exactly. And that worked. They played it brilliantly. It was a brilliant campaign in that sense, and it worked, okay? But that's why we got him. We got him for that. He would not have been, I don't think, the candidate at any other time had he not been running against Trump. And now, of course, you've got Trump, you know, running again. He's also showing he's more vigorous than Biden, but he's also aging. And he's also has a propensity to be stumbling over some of his words, etc. I mean, how have we ended up in America with these two once again running for president? It's extraordinary that a country of that size, of that scope, with that many people who they could choose from, and we get these two at the end result. It's a really bad advert for democracy, actually.
What a time to be alive.
Yeah, well, it's a time we are alive. So what we do about it, we're here, aren't we? You know, we're here.
What are Brits saying, if they're saying anything, about South Africa? We've just gone through this election. We've got a lot of change that's happened here. We were discussing before you came on some of the stuff that, you know, applies to the government of national unity, something we haven't had since 1994. What are Brits, if anything, saying about us? And what do you think?
Care about us?
Well, look, so I think what's been particularly sad about South Africa in the last two decades is that it has squandered all the goodwill that it had in the 1990s, say, from parts of the world which really did have an interest in South Africa at the time. I mean, you know, at the end of apartheid, South Africa was seared on everyone's minds and brains. You were in such a position to take advantage of that. You could have been such a leader, not only in Africa, but in the world, had you taken that moral suasion, that moral power, and done something positive with it. Instead, what happened? We had 30 years of the ANC essentially running South Africa into the ground, economically, but also, you know, through corruption, and also, of course, through mad foreign policy ideas that destroyed your position, frankly, around the world. And I think, sadly, a lot of people just turned their backs on South Africa in the last decade in particular and felt it will never change. It will never. What's happened there is so bad and so endemic that it just will not change. And why are they following these mad foreign policies that are taking them completely away from, if you like, the West, where they could have had such impact, and leadership within Africa, where they could have had such impact, instead of moving towards a Russian or Chinese position on so many things. And it's just been a huge disappointment. So I think, of course, there has been interest around the election results. I mean, people were interested to see the ANC lost their majority in such a smashing way. But I think that there's a lot of wariness about what this means. On the one hand, there is some enthusiasm. People think, oh, could this be the start of a recovery? Could this be South Africa abandoning these, you know, kind of very far out stances on foreign policy terms and starting to, you know, kind of, you know, act its position and come back? But there's also the fear that actually it's just window dressing. And what will end up happening is that it's just more of the same. We're going to not see South Africa as a serious player. And frankly, we need South Africa as a serious player. You're an important country. Your geographic position is really important. You sit, you know, on a major, you know, major route around, obviously, from east to west, west to east. And how you position yourself in foreign policy matters, because it's, you know, as to whether you're on the side, frankly, of those who value freedom in the world or those who are oppressing people. Currently, I'm sorry to say, for the last few years, you've been on the side of the oppressors. You've been on, you know, kind of the wrong side of the debate on many of the issues, supporting Russia, supporting China, supporting Iran in particular. And that is of great concern to us in the West, because you don't seem to be on the side of freedom right now. And so for us, it's going to be interesting to see if that changes or not. And I haven't said I'm not particularly enthusiastic about, you know, what's happened with the cabinet shakeup on the foreign policy side, because we were hoping for something different. It looks like we're going to get more of the same.
But, you know, Ellen, just given the last two things that we've spoken about, the shambles that seems to be American politics and where they sit and what they're doing, the porridgey space that the UK is sitting in, a Europe that is in itself going through a reckoning of who it is and how it is showing up into the world, versus on the other side where you're looking at, sure, maybe we do not agree with their policies, but an incredibly strong, determined, clear positioned China, a Russia with Mr. Putin at the helm that is clear about where they are and what they believe in and how they are going about it. You know, I'm kind of also feeling a little bit like the shambles that's happening on the West pushes a country like South Africa that's trying to figure itself and where it should be towards the other side, because they're frankly also quite, you know, not inspiring and the shambles themselves. So South Africa is sitting here, whatever their motivation may be, and there's lots of conversation happening here locally about whether it's a financial motivation, whether it's personal gains for some politicians, those motivations, particularly if it's financial and personal motivations, it makes sense to me why they would look more to the East and to those environments, because then they see over there, I know where I stand. I know what they are working towards and how they are working towards that. Let me try my luck with those guys. That, unfortunately, is also the situation that the world is in.
Well, yeah, look, that's the benefit, isn't it, of having a dictatorship of sorts, an autocracy.
Absolutely.
You can set the tone very easily. People know what you stand for, because you don't have to worry about the electorate. You don't have to worry about your own people. Mr. Xi decides at a flick of the pen, and, you know, policy is made for 1.2 billion people as a result. They have no say in it. Mr. Putin invades a country, you know, because he wants to, not because his people have clamoured for that to happen. So, yeah, that's an advantage, but they've always had that advantage. They had that advantage, if you like, you know, you've seen fascist and communist countries for years having those advantages. But of course, it's up to everyone, you know, who values freedom, who values democracy, who values human rights, real human rights, to look beyond that and go, okay, they have a clear view, but it's frankly an evil clear view. It's a clear view that wants to, you know, sort of make those values subservient to other values and wants to ride over international law and to do things in a certain way in order for them to gain benefit. And I think the problem lies in, I do think, by the way, the West has something to blame for this, because it lost interest in South Africa as well. It hasn't bought it, South Africa. It's forgotten.
Absolutely.
That during the Cold War, for example, we had to spend a lot of time courting people and going, let's talk to everyone who might be our friend to make sure they are our friend, and let's offer them something. Something positive, yes, a vision, but also, let's not kid ourselves, there is an economic aspect sometimes to foreign policy. What are we offering? What investment-wise are we offering? What are we doing to help anchor this country to the cause of freedom, democracy, and human rights? So I do take that. I take that we haven't paid enough attention, and that has to change. Clearly now, we're back into this free world, unfree world debate. Everyone has to be determining which side they're going to be sitting on, and it's up to us who stand on the side of the free to make that case in a compelling way and to back it up, frankly, with whatever those countries need to come to our side rather than the other side. And that's a challenge
Absolutely.
For our time.
Yeah. It really is. It's a crossroad that all of us need to really think through and consider, even as South Africans when we vote, and as we look at our politicians and kind of try and figure out where they lie and where their motivations are and how they act. It's important for us to push them into what we believe will also be beneficial for us and our children going forward. But it's just, for me, an interesting thing to look at. And, you know, the perceptions at play are always so hard to really pinpoint on. And when you talk about Biden and his people and who's doing what, the Weekend at Bernie's analogy is a very apt one, right? Because similarly, do you have an evil Mr. Xi on the one side who is doing whatever he wants and the way that he wants it, which has economic benefit for individuals within this country? Or do you have some kind of person holding a corpse on the other side and you don't know where they stand and what they believe and what the economic benefit will be for you?
I'm more interested in perhaps, you know, I haven't really spoken to Pumi about this much either, but Alan, I'd love to hear your thoughts and Pumi's on how the most interesting things happening in global politics at the moment are not on the grand scale. I mean, India had an election earlier as well. Not much to talk about there. I think it's happening on the smaller scale, South and Central America. I like what's happening in Argentina. I like what's happening in El Salvador. Let's talk about those guys, because Bukele and Milei are absolute juggernauts in their country. And in terms of the things that they're doing, those are seismic changes for the people of Argentina and El Salvador.
Yeah, and I think that is interesting, actually. You're right to sort of highlight that there are people out there, politicians out there, who are doing different things and trying to do different things and have been rewarded for doing different things. And I think the politicians who've done that have presented themselves, you know, warts and all. I mean, you know, you see that they're not pretending to be people. They're not. In fact, they're sort of embracing you know, their oddities almost, and saying, look, you know, we may not be the usual sort of politicians. We're slightly different to the norm, but that our country needs a jolt. We need to do something about it. And we're the only people who are going to break the system, if you like. We're the only people, because we are unusual politicians, who are going to be able to break into change and make those differences you want. And I think the interesting things about the countries you picked out are that the leaders are actually delivering on their promises. They promised something and they're delivering on it, and they seem to be very popular as a result. And that tells you that democracy isn't dead. It tells you that you can make an unorthodox pitch to people, and people will listen. And then the politicians, rather than carrying on business as usual and go, oh, we'll forget about these promises, we'll just, you know, kind of, we'll do what we always did. These politicians, because they've been elected, you know, freshly, have come in, they've not been jaded. I think politics jades a lot of people. The system jades you. It forces you to conform in certain ways. Yeah, I think if you come in from the outside, you can make a difference. And I think we'll probably see much more of that now, won't we? We're going to see much more of politicians who are not going to be afraid to make their pitch to the electorate in a bold way. And if they get rewarded, they will then put that pitch into action and say, look what the people have said. They've backed me. Now you, established parties, support me as well. And that's interesting in itself, isn't it? A lesson to all of us.
Fascinating, Gareth. Just talking of South America, we're hosting, Canejo is hosting a young Chilean exchange student for the past month. We've been living with this young man. And it's been fascinating having the conversation with him about the differences between his country and our country and what he's seeing and the many similarities. So Alan talking about politicians that are willing to give novel solutions to the problems that people are facing. More and more of that seems to be happening in South America and sweeping South America. And, you know, South America is known to try things out. They will try a dictator. They will try a bit of socialism.
I'm not sure the people have much choice about the dictatorships. They sort of, you know, military coups.
They will try
it much choice. But I know what you're saying, yes. You're right. There's been this tradition, look, whatever reason, in Latin America, you have this traditional position of the strongman, the caudillo. That's been there, basically. So they do like people with strong positions. Well, there's something in, I mean, again, I'm not suggesting that the dictatorships are popular necessarily, but there's been this view that you can have a leader who can make sweeping changes. And that doesn't often happen in the rest of the world, which is interesting. If you look around, it's rare to find that. Sometimes you get transformative leaders, but they're once in, you know, a blue moon. And you remember those people, don't you? Because they're so away from the norm. They did things so differently from the norm. Whereas it does seem to be a great laboratory there, an experiment in that way. Although, of course, we did get a hint, didn't we, of the dangers of military coups again with Bolivia. So there are, you know, it's an unusual place, Latin America, in terms of its political development. But in this case, you can see some pretty dramatic results in terms of people being elected this time with mandates and then carrying them through. And I think Chile, as you were saying, it's oscillated wildly from, you know, very interesting right-wing politics and what we might regard as crazy left-wing politics. But it does, you know, go wildly between the two, and the governments of the kind then do carry out what they say. So I think perhaps the lesson of all of this is, you know, if you get elected on a radical agenda, you've got to carry it through. But people do tend to be quite happy then with that radical agenda being carried out, because at least they say, well, they stood on it. We're going to let them see what happens and how that impacts on the country. And that, I think, is a lesson to politicians. You can be brave and be bold, and as long as you then are prepared to govern in the same way.
Woof. Yeah, I think that is actually that is a fantastic place, I think, to end the show and to say to you, Alan, because it's now 1 minute past seven. The polls are open. We will be watching through the night, and go out there and make it count.
Let's see. As one politician famously said, you know, vote early and vote often.
Good luck. Good luck. Thank you.
Thanks all. Right. Thank you. Love to be with you.
Thank you, Alan.
I've spent the morning with you, Alan. Thank you.
Alan Mendoza, thank you very much. And also thank you to Xavier Bapu, who was with us earlier. Thank you, Pumi Mashiko. And most especially, thank you to you for joining us this morning. Otherwise, what would we be having these conversations for if no one was listening? So thank you for all the feedback, too. I'm sorry we didn't get to every comment. There were lots of furious comments about all kinds of things. And we'll have to pick those up next week.
And we have to say, guys, you have to watch the socials. You know, we're trying to find ourselves and what we're doing over the next couple of hours. Sometimes we have a lot to talk about and we need the extra 30 minutes or the extra hour. We're figuring it out, guys. Just come for the ride. Be here.
So,
like, subscribe. Notifications, everything.
We'll try to give you as much warning as possible when we change the format. Like this morning, we threw in an extra half hour. But you know what? Lots of people watch it on podcasts or listen to it on podcasts, which means it can fit into your day wherever. And the more the merrier. So
like and subscribe, people. Like and subscribe.
Very good. This is The Burning Platform on The Podcast Party. We'll see you next week. Ciao.